This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 369 was produced a day early this week on Wednesday, March 29th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Best-selling author, former U.S. presidential advisor, and geopolitical consultant, Dr. Pippa Malmgren returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the escalating geopolitical situation, including Pippa's views that the Pentagon played a role in orchestrating the Silicon Valley Bank bailout to protect defense technology interests, and that China, rather than Russia, has been the principal aggressor from the beginning of the Ukraine conflict. I'm also putting a call out for help from our listeners to identify the ideal guest for an interview about the macro implications of the explosive growth in popularity and functional capability of artificial intelligence. Now, to be clear about what I mean by macro implications of AI, I'm not interested in having someone come on Macro Voices just to tell our listeners what an AI chatbot is or what the capabilities of ChatGPT are. Although I do encourage all of our listeners to create a free ChatGPT account at openai.com and discover those things for themselves through experimentation. I'm also not interested in having someone come tell us how to invest in AI by buying stock in companies like OpenAI. What I am interested in is finding just the right guest to take a really deep dive on how the societal implications of AI breakthroughs will translate to macroeconomic outcomes. For example, many of the jobs that are currently performed by mid-level office workers will be obsoleted by AI, just as the need for most travel agents was eliminated by the internet. That's likely to cause a backlash from displaced workers who will correctly claim that AI stole their jobs. I would think that this would cause increased social pressure for universal basic income and calls for taxes and protectionist regulatory measures limiting the application of AI technology to protect workers' job security. I would also think that division and resentment between the haves and have-nots will increase as more and more human job functions are obviated by AI technology. Put another way, will the latest advances in generative AI create more jobs, just as advances in technology have always done in the past? Or are the advances so great and moving so fast that they will cause mass displacement in white-collar jobs and change the social contract? I'm looking for an expert guest who's already done a whole lot of thinking about the implications of AI on society and particularly on the workforce, how it will affect deglobalization and the possible associated economic outcomes. If anyone knows who the perfect guest for that particular mission is, please email us at requests@macrovoices.com and let us know who they are and why you want to hear them on Macro Voices. Finally, please bear with us if your research roundup email is a little late to arrive in your inbox this week. Because we released the show a day early this week, research roundup emails may be delayed by a few hours after the show is released to your podcast feed.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. We are recording early this week, so the macro scoreboard is week over week as of the close of Tuesday, March 28, 2023. The S&P 500 was up 0.8%, closing at 4,001. We will take a deeper look at the S&P with the charts in the postgame. The U.S. dollar index was down 0.1%, closing at 102.42, continues to remain weak in the post-FOMC period. The May WTI crude oil contract up 3.2%, closing at 73.20. Gold down 0.3%, closing at 1973.50, that key 2000 round number resistance just overhead. Copper up 0.7%, closing at $4.08. Uranium up 0.3%, closing at $50.35. And the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 14 basis points, closing at 357 points. The yields retracing that extraordinary move that happened over the last month. The key news to watch, Friday we have that U.S. core PCE price index, and early next week we have the U.S. ISM manufacturing and services PMIs. This week's feature interview guest is geopolitical consultant Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Eric, why did we get Pippa back on the show this week?
Patrick, Pippa has always been a listener favorite, and she really got our attention last month when she posted to her Substack blog about the increasing risk of nuclear escalation in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We had her do a quick cameo appearance back on February 23rd, just to give us a quick update on that situation, and it's taken until now to schedule her for a full-length feature interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Dr. Pippa Malmgren is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is best-selling author, former presidential advisor, geopolitical strategist, and Substack author, Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Pippa, it's great to have you back on the show. For any new listeners who don't already know this, you penned a piece way back in October of 2021, before any of this Russia-Ukraine stuff even began, saying World War III has already begun. Then, just about a month ago, you penned another piece saying nuclear escalation risk has increased substantially in recent days, which, needless to say, got my attention. We had you on briefly for a cameo appearance on a recent episode of Macro Voices, but I've really been looking forward to getting you here for a full-length interview. So let's start with that backstory. How did you know back in 2021 that World War III had already begun? What is it that caused you to say that escalation risk, nuclear escalation risk, has increased substantially recently? And where do we stand overall now? How should we understand this big picture? Is it just about Russia and Ukraine, or is it a much bigger picture than that?
Well, it's great to be back, and I appreciate you giving me time to go into all these matters, and they do require time. There are no fast answers to the situation that we find ourselves in. So back in October 2021, and I hesitated at that time. I was very cautious about, you know, putting forward that phrase that we are already in a global conflict that I think history will call World War III. But at the same time, trying to convey that this doesn't look like World War I and World War II. This is, you know, every war is different. And so this is a technological conflict. I've been calling it the invisible war, actually, because it's not what it appears to be. So the media is totally focused on Ukraine, and there are good reasons, obviously, for that. But the driver is the media doesn't want to cover any story unless there's a human interest angle, meaning in very blunt terms, unless someone is dead, there is no story as far as the media is concerned. And so lots of things are happening that the public just doesn't see or doesn't clock, but they're materially important. So to back up, you know, I wrote a book in like 2016, 2017 called Signals. And my argument was that you don't have to wait for the data to tell you what's going on. There are lots of signals that are hints about the future that are not yet in the data. And I concluded from the signals I was seeing that we were going to see the return of inflation and the return of geopolitics. Now, this was at a time when the consensus view, the establishment view was crystal clear. Inflation was dead, and we were in a peace dividend that would have no reason to end. And now, you know, less than a decade later, we are in the midst of a serious inflation issue, which in my opinion was the direct contributor of a serious resurgence of geopolitics. And I won't go into the details of why inflation and geopolitics are interrelated, except to say that, you know, it starts to create pain. And then people start to think about, wait a minute, how much food do I have? How much energy do I have? What do I own versus someone else? And then you begin a contest for ownership of these assets once inflation begins. And I think this played a contributing part. It's not the total sum driver, but it played a major contributing part in the resurgence of geopolitics. And in addition, the separate issue was that we live in a world where as soon as China in particular started to get ahead, it started to produce global brands like Huawei. The reaction of the West was basically to say, no, that for whatever reason is not allowed. And the Chinese perspective was, wait, I thought that the rules of the game were whoever could produce the best products could take them to the global market under the World Trade Organization and sell them. And so anybody in the post-World War II, you know, landscape had a means of getting ahead and improving the quality of life, raising the standard of living for their citizens. But once you actually start to do it and you're successful, the West changes the rules. So that began to underpin a sense of frustration, particularly for the Chinese, I think also for the Russians. And then that's when they started to align and say, wait, let's rewrite the rules of this game. The post-war American-dominated, you know, World Trade Organization-driven environment is not what we thought. And so let's do a bunch of things that will change the balance of power. So it was gentle to begin with, but slowly but surely it started to accelerate. And what I saw by, you know, the beginning of 2021 was it's accelerating in such a way that we're going to end up in a conflict. Now, how that conflict has happened has been very, very interesting. And here I'll jump to the beginning of Ukraine. So, you know, I've said on your show before that this conflict didn't begin in Ukraine. It began in space. And we started to have events in space that were materially important. Satellite warfare, you know, various superpowers destroying their own satellites to create debris fields that would deny other superpowers access to certain critical orbits. We've seen the Russians twice blow up their own satellite to do this. It's a kind of a very physical denial of service attack. Now, why does anybody care? You know, when you ask a typical person, why do you care about space? Why does it matter? Most of them will be like, I don't know. It's kind of nothing to do with me. But then you say, yeah, but, you know, all our weapon systems depend on satellite guidance. And by the way, your whole life really depends on GPS, which is a satellite-based phenomena. I guess it's like people think electricity comes out of the socket in the wall, right? They don't think through the whole supply chain behind it. So satellite warfare and warfare in space, the race in space, for example, who's going to build the first military base on the moon, which is a very live race, and both China and the US keep bringing the date forward for that. All of that is about dominating this new domain without which one can't conduct war and one can't conduct an economy. So, but there are no journalists in space and most of it's classified. So the public kind of doesn't even know this is happening. And that's why the thing that really kicked off the conflict we're in now wasn't when the tanks from Russia rolled into Ukraine. It was many weeks before that when there was this incident in the Arctic Circle on this tiny island controlled by Norway called Svalbard, which has the fastest internet connection in the world. And somebody cut the internet connection there. And why is it there? Because most of the high altitude satellites connect to Earth at Svalbard, including the International Space Station. And that was the shot across the bows, which today is considered to have been, you know, the Russians that did it. But again, we're in an invisible war, so nobody knows, you know, a bit like Nord Stream 2, who blew it up? Lots of theories. Nobody can prove anything. Same with this incident. And so that set the West off in an understanding that, okay, we are now in an environment where all of the global comms could be shut down at any moment through warfare involving the cutting of subsea internet cables. And of course, we've had nothing but more of that ever since, including only a few weeks ago, someone cut the key internet cable, subsea internet cable for Taiwan. And we've seen the main subsea internet cable for Europe and transatlantic, also between Scotland and the Faroe Islands, which, you know, people are like, who cares about that? But that's where nuclear submarines from Russia would have to pass through to get into the Atlantic to become a strategic threat to the United States. So we've seen this, but, and it does get reported, but nobody kind of connects the dots and says, okay, we're actually in quite a elevated confrontation here. So then let me fast forward. So then Ukraine begins. And I think Ukraine is on one level, a very clever strategy for accomplishing certain tasks. One of them is, how do you raise the price of oil and food, right? Energy and food, because Russian military doctrine and Chinese military doctrine basically holds that anything goes. So whatever you need to do to disable or defeat the other side, you can. So why would you bother with a kinetic fight between, you know, ships and aircraft carriers when you can hurt the West much more severely by, you know, taking over a country like Ukraine, which is a main supplier of both oil and gas and food for Western Europe, and suddenly the prices of these things all go through the roof. And you ask the question, which damaged the civilian population of the West more? You know, a traditional naval battle or what's actually happened here, which is events that caused these prices to suddenly and dramatically rise. So that's the kind of way of thinking. Now, fast forward from there, with the media totally focused on Ukraine, meanwhile, you can do all kinds of things on other fronts, and all kinds of things are happening. So I'm following the military buildup in the Pacific. You know, we're definitely seeing China and the United States get into a more confrontational frame of mind. We've certainly seen with Russia that they've begun to escalate into other locations than Ukraine. So there's a great word that's very useful right now called irredentism. And irredentism means that as a nation, you have to go protect your nationals that happen to be outside your borders. And that, of course, was the original reason for rolling into Ukraine. It was to protect the Russian population from the attacks the Ukrainians were reportedly making on that population. Well, now the Russians have expanded and making that same argument in what I call the magical kingdoms. And I say that because most people haven't heard of these places. They sound like magical kingdoms, like Abkhazia and Artsakh and South Ossetia and Transnistria, Moldova, Nagorno-Karabakh. These are all locations that most people in the West are not actually familiar with. But it's the same picture. These are Russian enclaves where there is a Russian population that one can argue needs protecting. And that is what Russia is arguing. By the way, Svalbard in Norway, again, back to this Arctic Circle location, also has a Russian population, which Russia says needs protecting. So Russia starts escalating in other locations. And they start escalating when it comes to weaponry. And I'll finish with this. I know I'm going on, but there's so much detail that somehow nobody's laid out. So you've kind of got to go back and say, okay, here's where things have happened. Anyway, it's become clear. I mean, it's obvious that Russia's made many nuclear threats. And all of a sudden, some months ago, the U.S. agreed out of the blue to join Russia at the negotiating table on what's called the START talks, the strategic arms limitation talks. And that wasn't about Ukraine. That was just suddenly the US said, yeah, let's definitely sit down and negotiate on nuclear weapons and mutual inspections of nuclear weapons. And then that conversation very suddenly collapsed and Russia walked away from the negotiating table. And again, hardly anybody noticed because it seemed like a technical issue at the time. But because of my background and my work in strategic security, and you know, my dad worked as one of Kennedy's advisors on the Cuban Missile Crisis, it struck me as totally obvious that what was happening is Russia's threat to use nuclear weapons is not just about words. They are actually beginning to do things that make the West think that they might use one. And that is why we were forced to the negotiating table to stop that process. And then when the Russians walked away from that negotiating table, a bunch of other interesting things started to happen. Like, for example, Norwegian intelligence about a month ago released a big report. And, you know, if you Google Norwegian intelligence, usually there's just nothing there, right? There's nothing, no fingerprint, no signature, no nothing. All of a sudden, the head of Norwegian intelligence, the head of the Norwegian military, all come out and say, we think that the Russians are beginning to deploy nuclear weapons outside of Russia, the implication being on submarines. And we were starting to see lots of incidents of Russian submarines going through what's called the Juuk Gap, the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. And again, that's exactly where that internet cable got cut between the Scotland and the Faroe Islands, which is a crucial component of being able to watch what's coming in and out of that gap, which would mainly be potentially nuclear-armed submarines. And so the next thing, and I'll really finish with this, the next thing is every time Putin or the leadership in Russia threatened to use a nuke, China immediately came out and said no. And actually, we've just seen that again in the last week. And so what is this really about? I think it's really about China and Russia were aligned from the beginning. And Russia said, we hate the West. We want to throw a punch. We want a barroom brawl. And China said, that's a good idea. You should do that. So Russia throws the punch, which is Ukraine and more. And China got to watch what happened, which is a huge intelligence gathering exercise. It's of extreme value. And then when Putin took it a step too far, China steps in and says no to nuclear and starts to emerge as the good guy, a global negotiator the U.S. can begin to work with. And so I think this is really about the U.S. and China. And Russia itself has kind of collapsed back into a pre-Peter the Great geography, because I think pretty much everything east of the Urals is now effectively controlled by China. Perhaps not actually, the border hasn't moved, but effectively, China really is running a lot of Russia these days. And so Russia is becoming kind of less important. It's more of a vassal state to China more and more. And now the real argument is between the U.S. and China about what are the rules of the game. And the U.S. and China are fighting on various levels, commercial, military buildup. There's a massive military buildup happening in the Pacific right now. China's using their super dredgers to build what are called stationary aircraft carriers, right? They're islands that they can build in a matter of weeks using these things. The U.S. is building a massive new naval base south of Guam on an island called Tinian, which will be a very modernized Guam. And so that is my concern, is that we are edging into a superpower conflict, but in ways that are kind of invisible to the general public. And all the attention is on Ukraine. And people have the false hope and belief that when Ukraine ends, so does all the rest of this stuff. And I'm concerned that maybe we get to a situation where Ukraine ends, and only to find ourselves in a much more serious confrontation directly between the U.S. and China. And I think everybody in the West is trying to avert this outcome, but at the same time, they don't know what to do but escalate in response. So I'll finish there.
Pippa, I want to talk about the concept of annexation next. And, you know, people think about that word annexation. It's like when one country takes over another country, the way, for example, that Iraq annexed Kuwait and started the Gulf War. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about annexation of a conflict, because I think that most lay people are thinking about this situation. And the way they think about it is, oh boy, what if China decides to take Russia's back? And what if China provides Russia with some weapons so that Russia can continue to fight its conflict with Ukraine and, by extension, with the United States, so that China is giving some arms support to Russia while Russia fights its own conflict? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, Pippa, what if China essentially annexes the conflict with the United States and says, look, Russia, you guys are in trouble. You kind of botched this in a few ways. We're taking over. Get out of the way. United States, you're dealing with us now. You want a conflict with a global superpower? Russia was, yeah, there's global nuclear superpower, but they're nothing compared to what we could do to you, and we've had enough of your shit. We're taking over this thing, and first of all, is that a realistic concern? And second of all, fill in the blank. We're taking over this thing, and what would China's demand be if they were to really step in and say, we're top dog now, we're Putin, get out of the way, Xi is going to take this thing forward from here, we're going to deal with the United States. What would China's agenda be with the United States at that point, if that happened? And before we even get there, is it even realistic for my scenario to play out where China essentially annexes the conflict and takes over?
So I would put it very differently from that. And I would say this has all been China's strategy from day one.
Oh, so you think China called, she called up Putin and said, hey, we got a plan and this is what we want you to do for us. And that's how this all came about?
You don't even have to do that. You know that Putin is angry and that he wants to do something. And you say, what a very good idea. You should do that. Right? Like, it's the Chinese, particularly Xi, you know, he is a strategist. And yeah, I think that he sees Putin as a useful a useful tool for provoking the West in order to destabilize things in a way that are advantageous ultimately for China. So yeah, I don't think it's what you're describing. I think it was a plan from the start. And I think that the real experts on China, on Chinese military strategy, would agree with that assessment. So, you know, Putin, it's like, you know, when you have a gang and one of the gang members is particularly confrontational, there are times when you say, yeah, you should go hit that guy. And then the fight breaks out, and then, you know, the sort of godfather of the gang can step in and play, you know, statesman, broker of a deal. It's like that, except on a superpower level. So the word annexation is interesting, because I agree with you that I think history will show that China is gaining much more control over physical territory on the east of Russia. And that is the price that Russia pays for having China's support in this provocation environment. But what does it mean for the future of Russia? And that's why I think, you know, Washington understands they're not negotiating with Putin. They're negotiating with Xi, and that they have been from the start. They just didn't realize it at the very beginning. So then let's add into this the fact that Russia makes the nuclear threats, not China. And Russia is the one suggesting they're going to put nuclear weapons into Belarus, for example. And, you know, so China doesn't have to do those things because Russia does it on their behalf. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. So as I now understand your perspective, it sounds like what you're saying is China plays good guy here. They pretend, hey, look, we're the ones that are trying to broker peace. We're just trying to help the world out. You know, the United Nations ought to thank us for being the good guys in this story. We're trying to broker some peace between Russia and Ukraine and the United States. And in reality, you're saying, Pippa is saying, that really, China was the original provocateur who whispered in Russia's ear, or maybe even didn't need to, and just said, let's let them start the fight that we want to see fought, so that when the United States takes a swing and hits back, it's aimed at somebody else, not at us, even though we kind of started it.
Absolutely. And yeah, again, think about the intelligence gathering elements of this. It's incredibly valuable. And also, let's add that, you know, the U.S. is also accelerating the nuclear threat for China. You know, this whole so-called AUKUS deal, where the U.S., the U.K., Japan, and Australia are now going to have American submarines with nuclear capabilities. So, you know, China's like, yeah, you are accelerating the nuclear threat in our region. And that's obviously not what they want. So they've seen a larger negotiating process from the beginning. And again, one that is not actually about Ukraine. It's about other bigger domains, namely space and the high seas. And I think part of the reason this war, again, I keep calling it the invisible war. Part of the reason that this is so important is, you know, again, the media and the public are used to wars that are land-based. They're used to Afghanistan and Iraq. And, you know, like I said, World War I, World War II, you get a vision in your head. It involves troops. It involves tanks. It's a territorial fight. But we are now effectively in a naval conflict. And I would include space in that, because in a sense, that's just a continuation of the open ocean. And from the oceans into space, these are wide open domains where you don't see the action, right? There's nobody with a camera nearby. you don't see submarines, you don't see naval vessels, you don't see aircraft. And so it's not so surprising that we ended up, for example, with the Chinese balloon situation in the US, because it's about these wide open spaces. It's not about land. And by the way, can I just digress for a moment on the Chinese balloon? I wrote a long piece about the history of the use of balloons in warfare. And, you know, people forget that the Japanese also tried to use balloons during World War II and did get them into the United States. And in fact, did end up killing a family with them. I think it was in Montana. And people are like, well, it's just a balloon, right? So who cares? But not understanding the incredible strategic value. And so where did the Chinese balloons end up? Wyoming and Montana. What's in Wyoming and Montana? At a moment in history when the Secretary General of the UN says we're as close to a nuclear event as we have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis, well, what's in Wyoming and Montana are two out of the three American intercontinental ballistic missile launch sites. So if you're worried that the US and Russia are accelerating towards a nuclear conflict, you want to know what is happening on those bases. And what better way than to have a balloon that is above the air traffic lanes, but below the radar of NORAD, which is the entity responsible for incoming nuclear weapons. And you can hover and get footage, which then you can run through facial recognition. And, you know, people don't realize facial recognition is not about identifying, oh, that's Pippa Malmgren. It's about identifying what is my state of mind. Am I nervous? Am I confident? Am I rushing around? Am I calm? That's what they're trying to understand. Is the U.S. escalating their nuclear launch sites, given what the Russians are doing? And so that's really what all that is about. So bottom line is, I think this has been about the U.S. and China from the start. And Russia's just a useful Chinese ally that's co-opted into a larger strategy. And that's fine as long as the Russians don't actually go to use a nuclear weapon. Short of that, it does empower China enormously. And I think Taiwan is a very similar story. I don't think the Chinese want to actually invade Taiwan, nor do I think they need to, because most of the Taiwanese public make their living from China. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see the level of resistance in Taiwan, you know, should such a conflict happen. But what's really important is that by maintaining all these, you know, fighter jet flights into Taiwanese airspace, by surrounding Taiwan with Chinese naval vessels, by cutting the internet cable into Taiwan, all of this requires the U.S. to spend a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of resources, amping up their presence. And I think it's a war of attrition, that the Chinese won't actually trigger a conflict, but they'll hold us at this extremely highly elevated level of alert. And it's unbelievably expensive. And there's no easier way, in their view, to break the back of the West than to force us into a very, very expensive high level of alertness. So in a way, it's exactly what Ronald Reagan did during the Star Wars period in breaking the back of the old Soviet Union. It was just forcing a high level of alertness, which is an extremely expensive undertaking. And that may be the war that we're in, that we're not actually going to end up with a nuclear event, but we are going to end up atrophying under the financial weight of what does it cost to maintain this level of alertness across the open oceans and space? And the answer is it's expensive, to say the least.
So do I understand you correctly, if I were to summarize, to say that you think the end goal that China has here, may be to force an economic collapse of the United States government along the same lines as what occurred after, as you say, Ronald Reagan really tried to outspend and depress the price of oil and do things to cause the economic collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1990. You think China is trying to do the same thing? Do you think that the goal is a breakup where eventually, you know, it's kind of convenient that you have so much divisiveness in the United States where, you know, California and Texas break off to form their own sovereign states and you know, excuse themselves from being part of the United States. And the U.S. is a much reduced version of its former self. Is that where you think this is headed? Or I shouldn't say where the outcome is, but what China wants it to be.
Yeah. And I think that something that plays into this is the whole TikTok debate. And TikTok is viewed by the United States as a phenomena that it creates divisiveness. It diminishes the authority of the U.S. government. It's a mechanism for creating internal conflicts in the West. It's also an intelligence gathering mechanism. But this is part of the reason that suddenly TikTok is, you know, in the news. And I've over the years I've written about how is it we went from, you know, aircraft carriers being the military issue to TikTok, children's games. And the answer is because in a digital world and in a digital war, opinion becomes part of the war zone. And how do you influence opinion? Well, there's no better influencer of public opinion than TikTok. I mean, you could even go so far as to say that the Chinese balloon over the U.S. was the ultimate staged TikTok event. And what did it do? It totally undermined confidence in the U.S. authorities who, you know, ended up saying, well, actually, we've had these for several years. We didn't inform the president because we were afraid of the reaction. We can't really do anything about it. Like it revealed a whole bunch of things that have further, you know, undermined total confidence in the U.S. government. So that's why TikTok is seen as part of the strategic landscape and not as like a children's toy. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. So tell me where this is headed in terms of China's role. Do we eventually get to the point where, okay, the Russia-Ukraine thing blows over, they reach some kind of peace agreement, and then China emerges and says, okay, look, we're the top dog here, we're going head-to-head with the United States? Or does China continue to pretend not to be the aggressor and say, oh, no, we're just trying to broker peace between the U.S. and the various other people that we set them up for fights with?
You know, there's a famous saying by Sun Tzu that, you know, the best way to overcome an enemy is not to have to use any weapons at all, but just to wear down their resistance. And I think that is still the strategy. And so, yes, there's an escalation, but I don't think China really wants to get into an old-fashioned kinetic war with the United States. And so this is part of why we see, for example, both the U.S. and China are demonstrating that they can destroy each other's naval vessels. So if you Google it, you'll see there's something called the quick sink. It's what they call a J-dam. And it's a very specific type of weapon that the U.S. has. And the U.S. Navy has been demonstrating in videos you'll find on YouTube kind of since about May 2022. And basically, you drop a J-dam quick sink on a large ship, like a big old container ship, and it literally sinks immediately. It splits in half, and it is gone. And so why are these videos being released? It's to demonstrate to China, don't even think about getting into a fight with us because we can take out all your naval vessels like in a few seconds. You know, it'll just be done. And similarly, China is showing the U.S. we can build our own aircraft carriers. They're islands in the South China Sea, and you can't sink them because they don't float, right? And there's so this kind of taunting and escalation that matters to the military leaders, but again, the public isn't really paying attention to, is concerning, right? But I think let me finish on the really big issue. The really big issue, to my mind, is how do we create a world that Russia and China and Europe and the United States can all comfortably live in? Now, this is where it starts getting real controversial, because people are so angry right now with Russia. They can't imagine that we will ever return to a place where Russia is part of the family of nations. But we know from history that you can't cancel a country. You can't eliminate them from the landscape. And this is why we had the Marshall Plan. And we rehabilitated Germany at the end of World War II. There was the realization that asking for war reparations forever had actually drawn us from World War I right back into World War II. So I think we need to think now, even before the International Court of Justice and The Hague dig into what has happened in Russia. And I know most people are focused on, you know, revenge, justice, retaliation, all those very human things because of the horrific nature of the damage that's happened and the loss of life. But ultimately, from a global national security point of view, we have to figure out how do we reintegrate 1 billion Chinese people and the population of Russia, who, by the way, are not all huge fans of their current leader, right? You know, you can't say that every single Russia thinks that what Putin's doing is a great idea, because that's not the case. But how do we reintegrate them so that they have a better economic future, a higher standard of living and future, which means they don't want to fight? And frankly, in the West, how do we guarantee a better economic future for our own citizens, so that we don't have such internal divisions? And I think this is where the brightest minds now of our generation need to go. And given that this is a technological war rather than a traditional kinetic war, a lot of people from the tech sector are being effectively drafted into this cause, because it's whoever has the better algorithm, whoever has the better communication system, whoever has the fastest, most effective supercomputers. These are all tech projects. And by the way, this is one of the reasons that when Silicon Valley Bank blew up, who stepped in to start providing capital? It was the Pentagon. Why? Because the way you win this fight is through technology. So in that sense, I've argued we're all combatants now. We're all involved. This line between military and civilian is totally blurred in the World War III scenario that I'm describing. And I think all of those people understand there is no winning as in the defeat of an opponent. There is only coming to a solution that just allows everybody to stop fighting and go back to the fundamental business of how do we create a higher standard of living for everyone. But right now, it can't even have that conversation because, you know, immediately people start throwing around words like you're an appeaser. And I'm like, wow, this is so interesting, because I can at times be described as a neocon and at times as an appeaser. And what I find is no one is willing to have a rational conversation about what is really going on and what is the end game. What is the result that we want? Do we really want to have this escalate into a we can defeat you? And is that true? Can we defeat opponents in this modern technological world? Ultimately, will you end up back at a nuclear confrontation? nobody wants to go there. This is not the way we want the future to be. So what are your other options? Even if you were to, quote, defeat the enemy, okay, then what? What are you going to do with the results? So, you know, even if we end up in a situation where President Putin is hauled up in front of the judges at The Hague, which no doubt would satisfy many people, we still have this question, how do we bring all the bright, you know, switched on Russians and Chinese into a world where they too can have a better economic future? So as an economist, I see that the end game for all the strategic security problems is to get back to something like the line of thinking we had at the end of World War II. And we shouldn't have to wait for a major conflict to get back to that thinking again. We should use that Marshall Plan type thinking to avert that kind of catastrophic outcome.
Please elaborate when you say Silicon Valley Bank was bailed out by the Pentagon. That's clearly not the official story. It was supposedly the Fed and Treasury that did that. Do you have some inside scoop, or is this another example of it being unclear who the combatants are?
Well, like here, I'm literally Googling it as we're talking from 4 days ago. From Defense News, there's a headline that reads, SVB demise drew quick response from Pentagon, particularly the Defense Innovation Unit, right? So why? Because the Defense Innovation Unit understands that these are all their partners for building the technological infrastructure that's required to deal with modern conflict. So, and interestingly, this year, the defense community was at South by Southwest. The CIA had their own booth, and they were inviting, you know, everybody from the tech community to come in and sit with them. You know, let's face it, we have InQtel and all sorts of, you know, DARPA, all sorts of organizations that have a strategic security mandate, but are spending a lot of time in the tech world because, again, where is the competitive and comparative strategic advantage coming from? It's no longer like World War II, where it's, I have more ships than you have. It's, I have better technology than you have. So that's why I say, you know, where is the line between what is strategic and what is commercial? It's kind of, you know, there's this phrase that the military uses called dual use. And that means you could use technology both for, you know, combative purposes and commercial. And I look across the landscape as someone who's been very involved in tech across a lot of different sectors, but also in the security world. And I'm like, what isn't dual use? You know, what isn't? Everything from new materials to biotech, communications, like every single thing can be used either for commercial purposes or for combative. So I don't think we should be surprised. We're going to see the defense community more heavily integrating into the tech community and vice versa. And it's already begun both for China and for the US, which is why, by the way, the U.S. is banning so many Chinese tech companies, and why the Chinese are building a new strategy they call the Little Giants. Have you heard about the Little Giants?
No, I don't know anything about the Little Giants. Okay.
Well, the Little Giants strategy is that China creates probably 3,000 companies in China that form part of the core supply chain for key technologies. And they are aligned with the government. So their objective is not just to make a profit. It is also to serve the interests of, you know, of the nation. And so their strategy, it seems, is to integrate those sort of faceless, you know, unknown companies into the global supply chain. And then you wake up one morning and suddenly you can't get some critical component that is required. Or the components you're using end up being Chinese and either send data back to China or don't function when they should. Like, they've even found Chinese parts in the F-35. And you're like, wait, how did that happen? How did they get there? Answer, the little giant strategy is very effective. So this is, again, it's a commercial warfare that I'm describing that I think is very real and very important to understand and not very well understood.
Pippa, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk about your Substack blog, which is drpippam, Dr. Pippa Malmgren, .substack.com. This is really, I every time it comes up, I can't wait to read it, but it's really kind of transformed as all this conflict has happened. You used to write about a lot of other topics, but it's really taken more of a geopolitical focus recently. Tell our listeners what they can expect to find there and a little bit more about it.
Yeah, and the actual site, just to be clear, is drpippa.substack.com. Because nobody can spell my last name, except unless you're Swedish, right?
So, I thought it was Dr. Pippa M for the first letter, D-R.
No, no. It's actually, that's my Twitter handle is Dr. Pippa M. But
oh, okay.
The Substack is drpippa.substack.com. Well, so as an economist, you know, it's wonderful being an economist. It sounds so boring and people are like, economics, it's really dry. But I don't think so. I think economics is so fascinating and it touches every sector and it touches geopolitics, right? There, you can't separate what's going on in the world economy from geopolitics. I don't think you've ever been able to separate these two things. And technological innovation is, you know, at the core of the world economy. So I like to write about what's happening in the world economy that you should know about. Now, recently, I have written about military strategic things, but it's really to open people's minds up. Like, for example, I wrote a piece called War in an Era of Intelligent Machines, Stirrups, Conoidal Bullets, 3D Printers, Lunar Nukes, and Special Ops. And people are like, wait, what? Stirrups? And I was explaining that, you know, the innovation that allows wars to be won isn't always so obvious. And the way that the largest empire in European history and Asian history was established, the Genghis Khan Mongol Empire, was because of a very simple innovation. They started to use metal stirrups, right, on horses. Why does this matter? Because now you can wear armor on the back of a horse and you can have your hands free. And the Mongols were amazing archers. So they were able to totally sweep through all of Central Asia and into Western Europe and defeat everyone because they had metal stirrups. Well, so what's the metal stirrup of our generation? I would argue it's a 3D printer. It's the ability to create anything from an aircraft carrier on, a building, prosthetics. Like almost anything you'd need in a war, you can now 3D print it. So I was making the argument, is a 3D printer the stirrup of our time? But I've also written about philosophy. And I wrote a piece, which actually was the most popular piece that I've written, which was really interesting. And it was called Wishes, Love, and Cosmopoesis. And everybody's like, what the heck is cosmopoesis? And I was like, well, what's the core thing that really drives the world economy? It's people who are trying to build a different world for tomorrow. And cosmopoesis is the act of world building. So, for example, you know, Steve Jobs didn't make computers. He always said, I don't make computers. I'm building a world where bright people can create without needing to think about computers. Or Nike. Nike doesn't make shoes. It has created a world where people can be weekend warriors and they don't even have to win their races. They just have to run in them. And there are now loads of people who identify as, you know, a weekend warrior because Nike created that world. And so that world creation concept is so fundamental to the world economy. And it's so driven by love, love of a better and a different future. So it's not only writing about strategic security, it's writing about all aspects of what is this thing, the world economy, and how do we interface with it in a really positive and productive way?
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Pippa. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Pippa's picture that says, looking for the downloads. All right, Eric. Let's start by covering crude oil.
Because we're releasing this show on Wednesday instead of Thursday this week, I don't have access to the EIA inventory data. API, however, reported a massive 6 million barrel drawdown. That would be the biggest drawdown since Thanksgiving of last year. So if that is confirmed by the official EIA report on Wednesday, it could very well lead to a continuation of the rally that we've seen over the last couple of days. Renewed upside momentum on Monday took us back over the short-term moving averages. Really looks, if you take a look at the chart, like, oh boy, you know, it's game on. Maybe the bottom is in for crude oil. We're finally taking off again. I think the reason for that, though, is banking crisis fears are easing. And my question is, how long is that going to last? I'm not convinced that the banking system is as stable as everybody wants to believe that it is. So if the banking situation resurfaces, I think it could take crude oil back down with it. And how many times has this market given us bull traps? So we're just about at the right level for the market to roll over again if it's going to. I don't necessarily think that it will if we really have seen the worst of the banking crisis, and particularly if some of the supply concerns start to hit the tape. Maybe the bottom is in, but I'm not going to bet on it quite yet. We also have OPEC meeting next week, but so far there have been no hints of any quota changes, so I don't expect any big changes there.
Yeah, Eric, on page two, I have that crude oil May 2023 futures contract. And what I have here is the volume by price showing where the majority of the overhead resistance lies based on where the volume traded, as well as the 50-day moving average. And so what we had was earlier in March, a big breakdown in crude that saw us hit down that $65 level. And since then, we've been bouncing. But in technical analysis, what were previous supports and lows become overhead resistance when approached again. And while certainly it's been a strong $9-$10 push off of the lows in a span of a week or two, but the real tell for whether this is meaningfully turned is what the price action does right here, right now. If the bulls are serious about making a meaningful turn on this, we should see a solid punch back into the high 70s and a consolidation up there to really signify that the breakdown that we saw here in March was just simply a liquidity-driven short-term event that is now having oil restabilize in an area that will give an opportunity for a much more bullish reaction. But if for whatever reason crude oil failed here in this kind of under $75 range, then the trend of lower highs and lower lows would still be uninterrupted. And I wouldn't take off the table that a double bottom retest of 65, or even in the more dire scenarios, if we see some heavy selling, we could go right down to 60. Now, I'm not forecasting that yet, but this is such an important level for crude, and watching what it does here in the next few days is going to be really important. Nonetheless, let's move on. On page three, I have the S&P 500. And well, Nick, you know, I want to bring you on here. It's a really interesting price action in the S&P. Let's start off just talking about the levels.
Yeah, so looking at the past week or so, we've seen kind of a range-bound trade between, you know, 3950 or so and 4000, and we keep butting our head against that 4000 level, which is a very key area. So right now, spot is around 3980 to 3990 or so, based on what we opened up today on Wednesday. And I'm looking at the OPEX for Friday, which is the March 31st OPEX. the implied move based on the straddle for that OPEX is 60 points in either direction. So the upper expected move would be around 40-40, and the lower expected move would be around 39-20 or so. Now, keep in mind, we have the quarterly collar by JP Morgan with the call wall at 40-65 and a put wall at 3,800. So my thinking is that if we see a push above 4,000 today or tomorrow with Gusto, keep in mind we have GDP numbers tomorrow morning, we could easily push to 40-65 area by Friday. And then, you know, past that next week, it's possible we push a bit higher because in the short term, it seems that the Fed has kind of alleviated the fears of any more bank collapses. So looking at, you know, again this week, key support 4,000. If we break above that, then I'm bullish to 40-65 or so. If we fail that area, I think we could push back down to around 3,900 or so. And that would be my area of support to look at going forward.
Nick, I have to completely agree with that trade range. The 39.50 is also where on page four we can see is the 200-day moving average as well. The highs of March were all coming along where that call wall is. So this trade range has been in place for a while, and it may very well continue in the days to come, contain the price action. What will be really interesting is whether or not the bulls prevail. I mean, the bears had a shot at this when we had those regional bank failures, a huge fear surges in investor sentiment. And suddenly, you know, there was the conditions for a market breakdown, yet the market didn't break down. And so if we see all these fears alleviated, it does allow a reflexive rally to occur in the market. It'll be really interesting to see whether we can break those highs, because if we're north of 4,100 come next week, then the window really opens up for 42 or even 4,300 on the upside. Overall, I think that while the markets do have a lot of stress points that they have to deal with in the latter part of the year, but maybe there's a real chance we go higher before those risks really prevail. Nonetheless, I want to talk of NASDAQ, which has actually continued to be very, very strong on a relative basis. What are the levels on the Qs?
Yeah, so looking at the Qs, I noticed this week that tech's been a bit weaker than the broad market. You know, yesterday and the day before, tech was not doing too well versus the overall market, that being the S&P, obviously. But the key levels that I'm looking at right now are, spot right now is 308 or so. Upper expected move by the Friday OPEX, March 31st, is 314. And lower expected move is 302. Again, that's based on the straddle price for Friday's OPEX. Key resistance area is 312. And key support is 300, with a large call wall at 320 and a large put wall at 285. So again, if the S&P pushes higher, chances are the NASDAQ follows suit as well. But typically tech leads the market a bit, right? So if we see tech roll over, and you know, we're watching, you know, Google, Amazon, Apple, Meta, they're all sitting at key areas of resistance right now. If they break above those areas, then you might see a further rally in broad markets, because obviously the sheer size of these companies, they bring the market much, much higher or much, much lower based on how they move.
Nick, I have that NASDAQ 100 futures chart on page six. And while you're right, in the last few days, it has certainly consolidated, but this chart just looks so bullish. And it's so counterintuitive, because those fangs and a lot of the tech names were where so much of the 2022 bear market happened. But overall, in spite of a very strong surge higher, the bulls have actually contained all the price action very close to multi-month highs. And if for whatever reason the conditions continued to be favorable for the short-term upside, a break here anywhere above 13,000 could have us doing another short-term technical advance on the upside, probably even toward last summer's highs in August, where it was very just north of 13,600. Nonetheless, will that overhead resistance be beat is definitely the thing to watch this week. On page seven, though, we have the VIX and the volatility index back in March when the first crack happened in the regional banks. The VIX went skyrocketing up to the 30 level. But here we are again in the teens. Just like that, volatility is right back to the bottom of that trade range. What levels are you watching?
Yeah, again, you know, I've been watching the VIX, and I mentioned in the past few months that key areas are 20 and 25 or so, right? So we broke below 20 short term. We're at 19.34 spot, which denotes about 1.25% moves in the broad market on a daily basis. seeing suppression in the VIX leads me to believe that, again, the bears don't really have much ammo in the short term, and we're going to see more upside, as I said, on SPX and the Qs. But again, if we get some kind of news event that comes out of nowhere, you know, another bank failure, for example, that could cause a huge spike back to 25 and possibly even higher to 35 or so, which would cause, you know, a decline in the broad markets as well. Now, on page 8 here, we have the US dollar index. What's your thinking here?
Well, Nick, we had a breakdown on last week's FOMC, and really the dollar has just continued to remain very weak. Now, at this stage, it's on the table for a full retest of its previous lows as the euro and even the pound sterling continue to edge higher. What continues to be interesting is the Japanese yen continues to seem to almost decouple from this and is not staying in that bigger correlation. But right now, so long as those European currencies continue to show this kind of short-term strength, the dollar index going for a double bottom retest at 101 really does feel like the path of least resistance.
Now on page 9 here, we have gold futures. What are you guys thinking here?
We're struggling to overcome round number resistance at 2000. And we just had the futures contract roll. There's a lot of contango in that contract. So that's going to help it by a few dollars to get closer to that 2000 number. I'm still bullish, but there's plenty of room in this trading channel for a deeper correction before the bull trend resumes. The key will be closing and then staying over 2000, the round number resistance, for a few days. When that happens, that's when you could expect to see a big upside move start to take off. The next big technical levels to test after 2000 would be the March 2020 high at 2080, and then the 2020 all-time high at 2092. The upper trend line on the price channel, though, doesn't really get up to that 2080 level until around April 19th or so. And, you know, to get up to 2092 would be a couple days after that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we consolidate here for a couple of weeks before we see the next leg higher. But I do still expect eventually that we're moving higher. And I think that if we are able to break to new all-time highs, could be the beginning of a really big move up, especially if this banking crisis resurfaces and or if the Fed is forced to cut interest rates. But let's not forget that the 2020 high was on the back of the biggest stimulus in history at the height of pandemic fears. And the 2022 high was on the invasion of Ukraine with talk of nuclear escalation in the air. That means that these levels should offer plenty of resistance before the market eventually works its way through them. So I won't be surprised if, you know, by the 1st of May, if we get up and test those levels, but I'm not expecting to break out to new all-time highs overnight. I think it's probably going to take a while to get through some really tough resistance up there around 2080 to 2092.
Yeah, Eric, I agree with your consolidation idea, but so far, the consolidation has been more sideways than it has been downwards. The Fib zones lie toward 1900, and I would still view that as a tactical place to be looking for buy on dips, but the question is, will gold even give that? Overall, we have to respect that the prevailing uptrend is the dominant one, and what doesn't even show on this chart is that we are just a stone's throw away from decade highs, if not all-time highs. And really all we need is one real good bullish catalyst, and that round number 2000 resistance up above can get beaten and create a feedback loop that will drive potentially solid gold flows for even weeks or months to come. The big question, will it? And that's certainly the thing to watch. Right now, definitely the bulls have trend in their favor. We are consolidating here, but so long as old dips continue to be bought and the trend remains intact, more upside in gold remains my bigger bias.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.